Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Columbia University historian Adam Tooze, who wrote one of the best and comprehensive studies of the 2008 mortgage-based securities meltdown in his book Crashed. In his latest book, the economic historian examines the impact of the coronavirus pandemic while it still continues. Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economies, addresses the unpreparedness of the U.S., European, and world public health organizations, the reluctance of world political leaders to make difficult decisions which might have curtailed the pandemic in its early stages, and the profound changes to institutions like our healthcare, educational systems, and social services that the pandemic has wrought. Many of these changes will last far beyond the pandemic, including a newly muscular world banking system and accentuated inequalities and divides along economic, political, social, regional, and cultural lines. Adam Tooze is a professor of history at Columbia University. His book, Crash, was a New York Times notable book, the Economist's Book of the Year, and New York Times Critic's top book. He's also the author of Wages of Destruction and The Deluge. He formerly taught at Yale University, where he was the director of international security studies, and he also taught at the University of Cambridge. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Adam Tooze, welcome to Studio Tulsa again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Your previous book, Crash, was an excellent rear-view window view of the long build-up to the 2008 economic meltdown. Tell me about your decision to take on this economic and global health emergency while it's occurring.
It was a decision almost forced on me by events. I mean, Crashed was a book distilled out of the writing, the wisdom, the analysis of economists and journalists around the world in the aftermath of 2008. And I'm in regular touch with those folks and have been ever since. And so when specifically the financial crisis of the spring of 2020 started unfolding, and that's really the heart of this book, Shutdown. I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a virologist, but I am somebody interested in financial markets. Those people, my sources, if you like, for Crash just sort of started calling me up, started emailing me and saying, Adam, like, you know, how do we make sense of this? Isn't this like 2008? It's the same markets blowing up, or is it the same markets? How is this going to play out? And at some point, I had to kind of down tools. I had to stop doing the other project I was working on, which is a history of the political economy of the climate crisis, and just focus on this. And then I just became more and more interested as a historian in, okay, you know, I've written previously about, you know, the grand events of 20th century history. We are all living through, you know, an intensely dramatic period. What would it be like as an experiment to actually try and write it in real time, take the risks involved with that? Which, you know, basically, I mean, it's small beer by the standards of frontline medical people or soldiers or whatever. The risk here is just simply being wrong. So, you know, let's have a go at this. Yeah, that's the wager. It follows on directly. I mean, readers who've seen Crash will see that this is, in a sense, an extension of that universe. Can we extend that universe to this present crisis?
You know, you write that it could be the single most disruptive event in the history of modern capitalism. And when you look at the figures today, 221 million confirmed cases around the world, 4.5 million deaths, and probably both of those numbers are, if not gross underestimates, at least significant underestimates. And, you know, even if you look at the U.S. cases, probably underestimates on both levels. What does this mean for the future of world economy? Is this going to be a changing event, much like major disruptions in history? I'm thinking of, like, plague and things like that.
Yeah. It's difficult to see it not being that, right? I mean, it seems to me we're in the position of a sort of, you know, a middle-aged patient who's just survived a rather serious heart attack. And you kind of have to take a little, you know, a bit of a hard look at yourself and go, whoa. I mean, I'm fortunate to have come through that, but I didn't even know this was a possibility. And I do think it should give us that sense of a kind of fragility, vulnerability, mortality, quite literally. Because as Bill Gates has long time argued, if you look at the range of environmental hazards out there, many of them are terrible and, you know, catastrophic in their implications. But if you ask yourself which is the one of these that could kill a billion people flat out, it's pandemic risk, which has that potential. And what we've realized is that if we respond to that risk, that medical risk, in the way that our social and economic systems seem to demand, then from that medical risk also ushers a truly spectacular economic risk. And it's not easy to insert those kind of what, you know, economists and statisticians call tail risks into your calculus. We know most of us don't spend most of our time acting and living as though the worst possible thing could happen to us tomorrow. But if you're doing serious forward planning in future, you are going to have to calculate with the possibility of this kind of shock. So then you need to build in stabilizing mechanisms, right? You need to actually have at hand various types of stabilization mechanism. And this is true not just of the pandemic risk, but of things like climate as well, because those are the things that saw us through.
You spend a lot of time in the early part of the book just sort of describing the beginnings of the reaction to the fact that there is a novel pathogen emerging out of Asia. You know, everything from, well, is the right approach to shut everything down, or is it, you know, herd immunity? You know, you look at that. And, you know, the idea of a novel pathogen emerging out of Asia is not a new idea. In fact, we've had a number of new viruses emerge, and seemingly those pathogens have emerged in an accelerated schedule over the last 20 to 40 years. Mm-hmm. And so you describe the world's reaction to COVID as organized irresponsibility. Given the fact that this has been planned for, it's been gamed in military war gaming, it's shown up in public health exercises, why were we so unprepared?
I think fundamentally it's because the things that we needed to do to meet this crisis are outlandish. Like, if this was the real deal, then we needed to do things like shut down JFK. We needed to empty our school systems. We needed to seriously contemplate the fact that ordinary life as we knew it would cease, you know, not forever, but it would cease for a time. And all of this was simply beyond the bounds of the thinkable. The smart thing to have done in February would have been to, you know, shut down or at least reevaluate the flight patterns out of the great air hubs of the world, LA, Heathrow, in London, JFK. We should have been tracking and tracing immediately. We should have been doing at a global scale what the Chinese were doing at the scale of their vast country. And we simply, for all of our this planning, it just simply couldn't be moved within the realm of the realistic. And then astonishingly, 4 weeks later, that's exactly what we were doing. And if you were in a city like New York, it was an extraordinary, it was a ghost town. It was absolutely unlike anything I've ever experienced before in a mega city like this. And that was then replicated across every single equivalent city the world over. I mean, it was truly remarkable. So at that level, there was just a gap here between, you know, it's a bit, little bit like something like war, where you can endlessly think about it and people write novels and poetry and make films about it. But the actual reality of combat is a completely different experience again. And there was something like that about this experience. And the odd thing is, it seems to me it's slipping away from us almost, you know, as it's still ongoing. It still has a somewhat unreal quality.
Yeah, I think it, today, if you had to say, I think perhaps not in policymakers' viewpoints, well, some probably, it's probably divided, really, that some believe we're just going to stagger to herd immunity, and others are still urging separation, use of vaccines, and, you know, measured shutdowns to slow the pandemic's continued move through the population. But I think there's a good portion of the population that just, we're going to stagger to herd immunity.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the game changer here are the vaccines. I mean, that's, as it were, the other thing that we really learned in 2020. I agree with you. Otherwise, there's this sort of eternal battle between the people who just shrug and say, well, we'll just move on, and those of us who are trying to ameliorate the situation in various ways and minimize the risk. But the one instrument that we have that cuts that Gordian knot, that just resolves the issue, is the vaccine. And furthermore, our ability to, you know, these aren't things that existed, pre-existed. The fact that we were able to develop them and develop them in record time is a miracle. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary display of human genius and human technological endeavor. And not just in the United States with the famous breakthroughs here with the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, but around the world, there's a whole suite of vaccines. Even the Russian one turned out, for instance, to be highly effective, that we just didn't have as a capacity before. So that, for me, is the, it's still a puzzle, right? This is still a, like, people won't accept the vaccine. We haven't made enough of them to, in fact, vaccinate the entire population. So the virus variants are still going to emerge out of the unvaccinated population. There are profound puzzles, but that, if there's any chink of light, any agency, any real control we've gained on the situation, it's by means of that program and those programs.
You described the rise of the virus in China at the beginning of the book as a potential Chernobyl moment in the minds of many. And you said that viewpoint really cost the rest of the world. Why was that?
Because I think with the idea of a Chernobyl moment, and if you watch the HBO TV series about Chernobyl, you get this flavor very strongly. There's a sense in which it's exotic. It's sort of happening somewhere far away, of which we know little, where there are different rules. An authoritarian regime is going to screw up and get its comeuppance as a result of having failed to be open and transparent with its population. And then, as it were, liberals sit back and go, well, that couldn't possibly happen here. And that image, I think, was very strong in the immediate Western reaction to what was going on in China in January and February of 2020. There was a failure of reporting within the Communist Party and within the Chinese disease reporting system. It was easy enough to explain why that would have happened in an authoritarian regime. People don't want to be seen to have failed. It was, an inconvenient time for the Chinese authorities to be dealing with a crisis like this. They tried to suppress it. It got away from them, and they got their comeuppance. And the problem with that reading is what we didn't realize is that if Beijing was having to shut down so as to minimize the risks from Wuhan, New York had to shut down to minimize the risks from Wuhan, because Beijing may be somewhat closer to Wuhan than New York is, but we are irrevocably attached to the same global transport system, which moves millions of people around the world at the speed of jets. And that means that they are not in a separate world, in their own bubble, doing their Chinese thing, struggling with their Chinese crisis. If they have a problem, we have a problem. And that is what the Chernobyl image, as it were, veiled. It made it difficult to understand. We didn't think of ourselves as being within the ambit of the nuclear, of the radioactive cloud, unfortunately. As a European, Chernobyl has a slightly different resonance because the place where I grew up in Germany was directly affected by the radioactive cloud. To Americans, I think Chernobyl is something far, far away.
Yeah, and in fact, as we look at China today, their reaction is probably a success story, a great success story. I mean, albeit at, enormous personal, economic, and, cost, but they've contained the virus successfully than any other country.
They have. And in fact, they paid a smaller price than we did in the end, much smaller, because the key to dealing with an exponential runaway process like this is deal with it early on and deal with it decisively before it gets too big. And then you can combine the resources of a giant country like China to address it in one province. That one province may be larger than California. It's a very, very big place, Hubei. But and Wuhan is a city of 10 million people, so larger than New York City. But you can mobilize the resources of the rest of the giant country to address the problem there. It is true, indeed, that it has turned out to be a triumph for them. But it's, again, we have to go back to March, right? If the rest of the world had succeeded in containing this, this would have been the largest screw up, the largest disaster, the largest crisis that the Communist Party had suffered since the beginning of the reform period in the 1980s. I mean, this was a huge setback for them. It's our failures in the West after March that, as it were, turned the tables and allowed them to present themselves as having achieved a triumph. And that's the full measure of our failure here, is that we handed Xi's increasingly authoritarian and repressive regime a giant propaganda victory.
My guest today is Adam Tooze. He's a professor of history at Columbia University. His latest book is titled Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. It's published by Viking. It comes on the heel of his previous book, Crashed, which was a rearview look at the 2008 economic meltdown. Well, one of the things you do is relate the lessons we learned from 2008's financial crisis that the U.S. and various world governments applied to 2020. What did we learn from 2008 that we directly applied during the pandemic?
We learned how to deal with instability in financial markets. And in a sense, the message of shutdown about the 2020 crisis is, as it were, the sort of humbling lesson that that's actually the easy bit. Stabilizing financial markets, which was the huge deal in 2008, is in the end a fundamentally relatively simple operation. The financial markets may be complex in detail, but what they need in a crisis is relatively simple. They need liquidity. They need good collateral. The government can provide both. And to that extent, the financial crisis can be mastered. I mean, if you don't master it, it will take the entire system down. It is like a cardiovascular failure, a heart attack. It will destroy your entire body. It will seize up the economy. But our problem in 2020 was so much more multi-layered, and it went so much deeper into society, and it affected what economists call the real economy. It changed the way in which people worked, the way they produced, they consumed, they traded. And so what shutdown tells is the story, if you like, of the struggle to use the techniques of 2008 to stabilize the financial markets, and then the opening of the next phase of the battle, which was really about trying to stabilize the economic, political, social fallout from the crisis, which was much broader and much more recalcitrant. Yeah, in terms of dealing with the financial markets, the lessons are kind of one-to-one. There are certain things the Fed did in 2020, which are direct replicas, revivals of the sort of instruments they used in 2008. That's both for supplying liquidity, so free and easy dollars to financial markets, to financial institutions, but also to the world economy. I mean, the Fed really floods the world with dollars starting in March 2020. Earlier in the year, as the world began to panic, the dollar was rising because people run into the American currency in a panic. That exerts huge pressure on the world economy. So the Fed reversed that by basically opening the floodgates. And a whole variety of technical instruments were used, and they were used on an even larger scale than in 2008. The classic one is bond buying, asset purchases, so-called QE. And they were doing that at a just biblical extent in the end of March, early April 2020, buying $1 million a second in treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, $70-plus billion a day. So, I mean, really gigantic intervention.
Well, beyond the huge macroeconomic view, what about some of the things that were instituted in 2020? What worked well and what didn't from the American economic toolkit this time around? I'm thinking of things like everything from, you know, the Paycheck Protection Program, you know, obviously more recently, you know, rent protections and things like that. What has worked well in your view and what hasn't worked well?
I mean, it was really eye-opening, and it sounds so simple as to sound kind of almost banal, almost sort of absurd, but it is the case that we can alleviate not the causes of poverty, but we can alleviate poverty as such, the hardship of simply not having enough income in family budgets by writing checks. I mean, you know, and that's what the CARES Act did in 2020. And the astonishing thing, looking back, is that poverty fell in a year in which unemployment surged. That ought to be a lesson. Like, if we are serious about alleviating the suffering, and I think that's the right word, the precariousness, the desperate hand-to-mouth existence of tens of millions of people, families with kids, that live around us, amongst us, in American society, then we do, in fact, have the necessary means and instruments to solve this problem if we have the political will. And there's an element of courage involved, because you will be criticized for doing this. But if you want to address that problem, you can do it. Does that solve the structural problems, the sources of disadvantage, which are so multiple and so complex? Of course it doesn't. But alleviating the problem in the short term is, to my mind, priority in and of itself. What we also learned is that basic institutional structures are missing in the United States. So what doesn't work is the unemployment insurance system. And it's really a scandal that a country as rich as the United States should not have a more comprehensive and adequate and adequately generous system for supporting people when they lose their jobs. And the system is a patchwork. It came out of the New Deal. It was very difficult to do a national bargain. And predictably enough, states in the South, for instance, in the US, have much more punitive unemployment benefit systems, very short periods for benefits. It's very difficult to get those benefits. And as we saw with those terrible pictures of people queuing up, the systems just fail when they're put under pressure. And so it's a pie-in-the-sky kind of utopian request, but if there was something that you would do that would, as it were, proof American society against shocks in future, because we had the same problem in 2008-09 as well, is that you would deepen and expand and solidify that network. Because otherwise, when the going gets rough, you have to scramble to produce, you know, the sort of supplementary system which has expired. It expired over Labor Day. To just tide people over.
You also spent some time looking at the economic model of our medical system, hospitals operating on a commercial principles, and what that meant during the pandemic. What did you learn about how hospitals, the way they've, you know, they're maximizing patient turnover, minimizing surplus beds, oftentimes they're they're just like every other business. It's inventory on on demand when you need it, as opposed to having huge stocks of materials there stored at a hospital. What have we learned about our medical system from this event?
Well, what we learn is that it's vulnerable to shocks. I mean, all of that kind of optimization approach makes sense, right? It makes sense from every point of view. There's no reason to, it's a net resource loss to society to have stocks of things sitting around idling, deteriorating in quality, and in the end you have to throw them away. No one wants, that's waste, that's just flat out waste. It's not even good for patients to spend more time than they absolutely have to in hospital beds, much greater risk of infection, and the body atrophies if you spend too much time in the manner of the 1950s and 60s where patients were positively warehoused in hospitals. So for all of those reasons, this model is not just bad, but it only works at all when you know what the incidence, the morbidity, the disease pattern is going to be, when you can predict the number of patients that you're actually going to get coming through the door. And that's what a pandemic really exposes, is the vanity of assuming that you really can predict that. At that level, it's clear, I think, going forward, that we are going to look for resilience is the key term here. Efficiency is something that's desirable, and we should want it in our system. We should also want a fair distribution of the profits that derive from efficiency, and that all too often is missing in the US. But we also need resilience. That isn't going to by itself solve our problem. I mean, there isn't any degree of excess capacity in the hospital system, certainly none that we could conceivably manage, that would secure us against the kind of pandemic surge that we've seen. We need other measures as well, like you were saying earlier on, social distancing, vaccine. We need the whole suite of measures. But certainly, we would have slept in a city like New York, we would have been calmer in March and April, if we had larger reserves of ventilators, if we had larger, I mean, those images of the poor nurses in hospitals in New York improvising personal protective equipment out of, garbage bags. It was humiliating, shameful, terrifying what those people went through, and the inability of a city like this to provide basic hospital cover for its population in a situation like this. Obviously, it should be a priority to ensure that that never happens again.
Well, one of the things that you write about is, how the world managed growing debt, especially in emerging economies, in places where debt was already a factor. It's become even a greater factor. And not just, here in the United States, where people are concerned about the size of debt. And of course, the reaction is, we have to do what we have to do. But is global debt something we're going to be faced with, say, in 3 to 5 years, or maybe even next year, just the sheer amount of debt that is accumulated out of the pandemic?
Yes. I mean, it's important to qualify that, that somebody's debt is somebody else's asset. So the counterpart to all of those debts are investments, right, in people's portfolios. If you hold an exchange-traded fund, an ETF in emerging markets, you've got a slice of that debt. That's what they invest in. If you've got something in a money market mutual fund, it's in debt, it's in government debt, because debt pays interest. And that's the basis of the deal here. It becomes worrisome if interest rates are high and if the people who borrowed the money don't have the income flow necessary to sustain payments on it. Otherwise, it's a fully functional arrangement that, as it were, we all in various ways are entangled in. We literally just couldn't function without it. Debt by itself, therefore, is not, is not of any reason to panic. The balances on each side are going up, and that so means the juggling is more complicated. But the world is incredibly bifurcated, right? In many parts of the world right now, interest rates have barely ever in history been as low as they are, including in the US. But in Europe, it's particularly egregious. Like, notorious crisis cases that we would have bored our listeners and readers with a few years ago, like the Greek debt crisis. Greece can now borrow out to a 5-year time horizon at negative interest rates. It's incredible. In other words, people will pay Greece to take their money for 5 years. On the other hand, if you are a struggling emerging market or low-income country, you were in trouble before the crisis hit, and you're in even deeper trouble now. What didn't materialize is the epic global debt crisis that many of us anticipated and warned about in the spring of 2020. So in fact, the finance side of this is one element of the story that kind of went better than we anticipated. This goes back to this question you were asking about lessons learned. We have, in fact, learned a bunch of lessons about how to manage debt, the piles of debt, how to stabilize them financially, the instruments that we need. And in a sense, to reiterate the point I made earlier, that's the easy bit, right? The real problem for a country like Ecuador is not its debt fundamentally. Its problem is, can it sustain production, earnings, export? Can it provide decent jobs to its population? Can it keep its urban population safe? A country like Peru was able to borrow for a century at the end of 2020 at interest rates which were historic lows, 2, 3, 4%. It could borrow money for 100 years. But Lima, its capital, remains one of the absolute COVID hotspots because 70% of the population in that mega city of 10 million plus people have informal jobs. The problem for Peru was not in the end the money, the debt. The problem was, how can it sustain, you know, the output of rare earths and copper and so on that it grows rich from, and how can it distribute that wealth and that income to its population at large and provide them with security? The problem here is the real economy, the actually doing of the important things that we need to do to face a pandemic like this, not so much really the paying for it.
You know, as this book went to press, and I guess it was around April 2021, you know, vaccines were rolling out for everyone in the U.S., and it seemed that the worst was behind us. That's gallows humor there, because we're deep in it still yet. But the last line of your book was, if our reaction to 2020 was disbelief, the watchword for the future should be, we ain't seen nothing yet. Have you been surprised by the events of this summer and this fall so far?
No, this is unfortunately kind of exactly what a drearier version of the prognosis would have been. I mean, it does stagger me that we do not have a more adequate global vaccination program. I mean, the IMF estimates the return from that program to be in the order of $8 trillion. And the estimate of the cost of doing it is somewhere between 50 and 100 billion. Now, you know, your listeners can do the math. That's a big difference. It's a huge rate of return if we could organize that funding. And economists and political scientists are pretty much universally of the persuasion that, you know, trillion-dollar notes aren't left lying around on the sidewalk. Like, somebody picks that up if that's a real option. And we have not picked it up. That is, I think, the surprise to me, that the gap between what we're capable of doing and what would clearly be best for us, not just for the world at general, this is not some altruistic thing, for us, and what we're doing to, as it were, seize those opportunities, take advantage of them, and stabilize the world, is so huge and continues to be so huge. That for me is, like, it's still just, it's jaw-dropping.
Hmm. It's a very interesting book. Lots of detail on what happened within the economic systems that sustained us during this shutdown. The name of the book, Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. Adam Tooze, it's a pleasure again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Adam Tooze is a professor of history at Columbia University. His new book is titled Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.